This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, is religious freedom legislation anything more than anti-gay bigotry? Also, is Spike Lee right that gentrification is destroying Brooklyn? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Frozen, it's Disney's latest animated juggernaut. Then, are writers the ultimate procrastinating perfectionists, or are we just lazy? And then, remembering actor, director, writer, and Ghostbuster Harold Ramis.
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
What?
Don't cross the streams. It would be bad.
What do you mean bad?
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
All right, that's bad. Okay. All right, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, a conservative Republican, this week vetoed a religious freedom bill that would have legalized certain forms of discrimination against same-sex couples. It's just the latest state where such a bill has gone down to defeat in the face of a backlash from people who call such laws anti-gay segregation. Is this another tipping point in the civil rights battle of our time? And then Spike Lee, Brooklyn-bred, unleashes a profane tirade about how gentrification is destroying Brooklyn. Is he right? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Arizona Governor Jan Brewer vetoed a religious freedom bill passed by the Republican House and Senate in her state. Arizona faced a potential economic boycott, even a loss of the Super Bowl, if that bill had become the law. It is just the latest such religious freedom bill to go down in the face of public pressure. A similar bill died in Kansas. Another one, I think, died in Georgia. There are other states where these bills are wending their way in some fashion or being considered, but it's hard to see them really surviving. The bills tend to nominally be about making sure people had free exercise to practice their religion, but have been cast, I think, very successfully and truthfully as laws that would encourage, permit, license discrimination against gays, particularly against same-sex marriages and weddings. So, Emily, what is the legal logic of the people who want these laws passed?
Well, there's an illogic at the heart of this, but to give them their due, the idea is that if you are someone with a business and for religious reasons you don't want to serve gay people, you shouldn't have to. That's the idea. Now, the way the laws get drafted, they don't want to be specifically targeting gay people because that is gross and so clearly unconstitutional. So then they become these more general laws about how if you have a moral or religious objection, then you don't have to serve whoever. The problem, of course, is that that is so open-ended that you can imagine all kinds of weird but plausible hypotheticals where you wouldn't have to serve, you know, Jews, Mormons, people who take peyote, whatever. And then they become very unworkable. But I think the main reason that these laws are so ridiculous and such an overreach is that they are being proposed in states that don't protect against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So there's just absolutely no need for them. What happened in Arizona was that next door in New Mexico, there was a photography company that refused service for a gay wedding and got sued and won. But the reason that gay couple won was that New Mexico has an anti-discrimination statute that protects against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Arizona has no such law.
So if I'm a business in Arizona, even a business that serves the public, I can decline service to anyone who's not covered by a particular discrimination
right.
statute for any reason. I don't like the way you look. You're gay.
Everybody in the whole country cannot discriminate on the basis of race, ethnicity, in most cases gender. We have this list of what we call protected classes that are covered by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Sexual orientation, gay people, they have never been on that list. The Supreme Court has never given them that status. Congress has never passed a federal anti-discrimination law that deals with homosexuality. And so, yes, you can already refuse service if you are in Arizona. And I think that was where the laws just completely collapsed and just seemed to be about bigotry for the sake of bigotry.
So I have two questions, Emily. One is, in New Mexico, though, didn't the court find that the photographers were discriminating against the same-sex couples?
Yes, because New Mexico has a state statute that says that you can't discriminate against gay people for being gay.
Okay, because there was some private parties thing that I didn't understand.
Well, that's actually interesting. So the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is the 1993 law that Congress passed to protect religious rights and sensibilities, that law is about what governments can and can't do, right? So the idea is that this is why it's coming up in the context of the contraception mandate that's in Obamacare, that the government can't excessively burden religious freedom without having a really good reason. That's how that law works. So in New Mexico, the photographers tried to invoke this, but they're not the government. They're a private party. And so the court said, you know what? You don't have any rights under this federal law as a private party. And that was the first of its kind decision, opening up a really interesting set of questions. But again, this is not really has nothing to do with Arizona.
What did you think of the Westboro Baptist Church argument that the guy in Arizona made, which is essentially, if I'm a cake maker and the Westboro Baptist Church comes to me and says, I want you to write this incredibly offensive thing on your cake and I refuse to do it for religious reasons, that's why we need a law like this.
Well, I thought that was really weird and interesting. I mean, the hypotheticals flying around are fascinating to me. So if that hypothetical is the idea that your religious sensibilities go up against someone else's, right? Because the Westboro Baptist Church people are saying, we can write and say God hates fags all over the place because that's our religious belief. So then you want to say you don't have to serve them. So that's fine. That's an interesting dispute. It's about competing religious beliefs. It's not about homosexuality and protecting the rights of gay people and whether to serve gay people. And yet that was like the best argument the religious people could come up with.
Is there a way, Emily, short of a constitutional amendment or, I guess, federal legislation, that sexual orientation, becomes a protected class in the way that race is?
There's two ways that could happen. I mean, one is that you could have a federal civil rights law that creates that category. That's what we have in Title VII that has race and gender and ethnicity and religion in it, or has been interpreted that way by the courts. And so you could just have Congress decide to add gay people nationally to that list. You can also have the courts do it. And in fact, arguably, the courts are moving in that direction. You know, this whole debate over strict scrutiny and heightened scrutiny and rational basis, these kind of tests for when court strike down laws, that debate, which I find to be incredibly annoying because it's so couched in legal jargon, but it's basically about exactly this. It's about how good a reason does the government have to discriminate against you if they're doing it because they're gay, you're gay. And in the cases of these protected classes, we say the government has to have a really, really good reason. We're going to look with strict scrutiny at those laws. We're going to be really skeptical about the government's reasons. Gay people and sexual orientation have never gotten that treatment from the Supreme Court. But when you look at the gay marriage decisions from the court last term, I think essentially Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority decisions and basically has written all of this jurisprudence, he has created a kind of de facto heightened scrutiny test for discrimination against gay people. And that is the main reason all these district courts around the country are striking down state gay marriage bans.
So it can become judicially, jurisprudentially, it can become strict scrutiny if the Supreme Court kind of just discovers that that is a right in the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court was the one that discovered strict scrutiny for race, ethnicity, etc. They can just discover another group. And this question of whether homosexuality is an immutable characteristic is tied to this, right? Because that's why we care about, particularly worry about discrimination against these protected classes.
John, you have a whole bunch of states where these kinds of laws have been proposed. Some have gotten all the way past legislatures, some get passed through one house. Sometimes they're in committee. Sometimes they're just talked about, almost all in conservative states. These are laws that are broad. They're about religious freedom, which is something Americans kind of intrinsically support, especially in these conservative states. Yet, with relative ease, in very quick succession, these laws have just been shot down. Which suggests to me that almost any attempt to legislate against sexual orientation and certainly to legislate against same-sex marriage is doomed in this country.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But I think that these are sort of the most aggressive efforts and are falling of their own flaws. I think that pro-traditional marriage forces will now and mostly spend their times protecting the 29 states where there have been either referenda or something. Like Ohio is a great example. And Ohio is a fascinating example because you have a debate within the same-sex marriage or marriage equality community about whether to put something on the ballot in 2014. One group saying, yes, we got the momentum. It's amazing. The tide of history is rolling. We've got to grab that and have a referendum. Others who are saying, no, don't have it in an off year where Obama's unpopular and where the turnout will be all in favor of conservatives. You'll make it look like there's underlying support for this when if we wait and do it in a presidential year, particularly, say, if Hillary Clinton's running, you could actually get a referendum to pass. And that seems really interesting to me. But I think the traditional marriage groups are protecting those 29 states. That's where it seems to me a lot of the bulk of the effort is, not in trying to get these kinds of things passed.
Although we had another state apparently fall this week, Texas, Emily, right?
Yes, but he stayed his order, so that'll now go up to the Fifth Circuit. At some point, there's got to be a circuit split, which is why these cases about like state gay marriage bans are bound again for the Supreme Court.
Explain what that means, Emily.
The circuit split is when there are two different federal appeals courts in different parts of the country that come to different conclusions about the law. And that's when the Supreme Court is supposed to step in, because you're not supposed to have one thing legal in one part of the country and the opposite legal in another part of the country.
Can we talk briefly about a sort of cul-de-sac on this, a First Amendment cul-de-sac here? When you talk about the photographer, so these New Mexico photographer, wedding photographers who didn't want to take the gay clients for their marriage, and they lost their case and I guess were compelled to photograph this wedding they didn't want to photograph. And there was a free speech element of this, which is, are they being forced into a kind of artistic expression when they have to go photograph? And it was actually raised to me an interesting question, which is, if you're hiring someone for a service like photographing a wedding, can you say that what they're doing has free speech protection? And I, as a kind of free speech absolutist, I found myself tied up in knots about this.
Isn't it a rights question, though? Once you hire them to take a photograph, you own the photograph, and therefore it's no longer...
But can you make them take the pictures?
Oh, right.
Or is that a violation of their free expression? And could we make the same argument about people who are dancing or playing music? Or what about baking? Is there like a... First, I guess, baking.
Would
baking
shadow puppets be in that? Because I'm not sure.
I think shadow
those
puppets,
are sometimes
yes, baking,
really expressive,
though.
But...
I wonder if the question of a wedding photographer is a wedding photography speech in the same way. We had a very arty wedding photographer who I think actually, you know, owned the negatives, what he shot of us, and he can use it as art. So wouldn't he have if he was really radically opposed to photographing someone's wedding, wouldn't he have a good, strong case there?
This New Mexico case is being appealed to the Supreme Court, and there's a brief by Eugene Volokh, who is a staunch First Amendment defender at UCLA, making exactly your argument, David. It's an interesting one.
What do you think, Emily?
Well, I'm not a First Amendment absolutist, and I find these distinctions between speech and conduct to be pretty meaningless in these contexts. I also feel like basically wedding photography is a transaction, a commercial transaction, and I basically am okay with... telling the photographers they just have to take the damn pictures. But I see the principled argument on the other side.
Coming up, are hipsters destroying Brooklyn? Spike Lee says they are. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Let us listen to a snippet of film director, Brooklyn-bred, Brooklyn-born Spike Lee talking last week.
I mean, they just moved in the neighborhood. You just can't come in Bogart. I'm for democracy and let everybody live, but you gotta have some respect. You just can't come in where people have a culture that's been laid down for generations, and you come in now, she gotta change because you're here? Get the f*** out of here. Can't do that.
So that was Spike Lee in a full Spike, curse-filled rant about the gentrification of Brooklyn, where, to hear him tell it, rich white people have come in, priced out the original residents, complained about neighborhood traditions like drumming in the park, overwhelmed the place with purebred dogs, changed the name of neighborhoods, and generally made life very different. So there are two complaints I've heard so far about Lee's rant that he did. One is that he is a hypocrite, that he himself made a fortune in real estate, especially in Brooklyn real estate, even though he no longer lives there himself, that as much as any person on the planet, he helped create hipster Brooklyn, and he's a hypocrite for attacking it. I do not find that criticism interesting. Seems to me...
Separate and apart from whether it's valid.
Yeah, I mean, it seems... Well, it's obviously true, but it's not... like, so what? I mean, hypocrisy is a lesser sin, I think.
John and I are always much more interested in democracy.
Well,
than you
I mean, to the extent that it erodes the standing of like high horseism.
Get to the merits, though. Let's get to the merits of it. Is there a merit in the case against gentrification? He has sort of three points. One is that newcomers don't appreciate the culture that's there and try to change it. The other is that old timers are priced out, particularly old, I think, African Americans and other minorities who've been there for a generation or two generations, who ended up there because they were redlined out of other parts of New York. And now they're being forced out by income out of these neighborhoods. And then the third part, which is I find totally incoherent, is that it was somehow better in the olden days when the trash wasn't picked up and the schools were worse. But at least we had each other, I suppose, is his conclusion. Case. Someone going to defend the Spike Lee argument? Emily, can you stand and defend this so then I can attack you?
Here's what I find confusing about this. I'm very pro-housing integration, which by which I mean not just race but also class. Like, if we had class-integrated housing in the cities of America, we would have better everything, better employment, better family structures, better schools. I really think it would make a huge difference. We don't have it because wealthy people generally bump rents up and then poor people can't afford to live there. And also, frankly, affluent people usually want to live among other affluent people with all the services that go along with those things. And poor people tend to make them nervous. So to the extent that Spike Lee is complaining about that, I'm with him. I'm just not sure what the answer is, because the truth about gentrification is that as it is happening, it is actually a moment of integration, right? The problem is that it then, if it continues, tips over and you take a neighborhood that had, you know, working class black people in it who were older and you turn it into like hipster fedora land with useless facial stores instead of like the regular old drugstore on the corner.
Well, if it's a useless facial store, it will not survive. People won't shop at it and it will die and
but
be replaced.
But people shop at all kinds of useless places.
Show me a neighborhood which isn't going through transition and isn't going through migration, I will show you a neighborhood on its way to death. I mean, this is what happens. You have transitions. Neighborhoods grow. They prosper. These at Fort Greene and Park Slope and all these places are victims of success. They're victims of people wanting to be there because they're nice places to live. And it's great to have more people live in there, more people there to get the trash picked up and to harry the schools into getting better. And
yeah, but
are there
you
costs?
Have to leave if the trash is getting picked up, but then you can't pay the rent anymore and you have to go and you've lived there your whole life, that to you is a loss.
It's a terrible loss, but how do you...
Well, if you had a neighborhood that was planned and zoned in a way where there was some affordable housing in it and there continued to be, you know, Section 8 vouchers or some way that some poor people got to stay and benefit from the improved services, that would be better, right? That would be not gentrification, but simply integrated housing. It's just that keeping a neighborhood in that kind of symbiosis, we very rarely see
to a larger question, which is that there's a blame cast upon the hipsters who've come and uprooted a neighborhood and changed it and indeed pushed people out who were poorer and who now have to live further out. Although I would say in the case of New York, it's good in the sense that there's still plenty of room for poor people to live in New York. It's just different neighborhoods and further out, perhaps from a center.
Perhaps. It is further out and then their subway rides are longer and they feel more remote.
This goes back to the conversation we had in San Francisco. Would you rather have the rich people all living in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, all living in, you know, the far suburbs of Philadelphia and having rich enclaves out there? Do you want cities that are donuts with a hollowed out middle where there's only poor people in it? Or would you rather have the prosperity be in the center, making those vibrant downtown dense cities, and the poverty spreads out from radially from it? I would much rather have that.
Of course we don't want. I mean, I lived in that hollowed out city of Philadelphia through the 80s. It was alarming. I'm so glad Philadelphia is not like that anymore. And in my own city of New Haven, we could use a little more gentrification, frankly. But that doesn't mean that the other side, once the wealthy people have come in and populated and multiplied and taken over, is so great for the poor people.
No, I'm not saying it's great.
No, she's not saying that.
What I'm saying, there's a blame that's cast on hipsters for something that has nothing to do with the hipsters. There is an economic problem in this country.
That's too easy.
There's an economic problem in the country, which is that there aren't a lot of jobs that poor people can get that are good jobs for poor people that will allow them to have a living wage. And the pushing out of poor people from downtown neighborhoods heightens that. It shows that. It's another example of it heightening. But you cannot blame the hipsters for the fact that there isn't like a you know, a car plant with union wages located in Red Hook. I mean, that's just the hipsters are can't
produce
that.
Well, you're assuming a world in which there's no – I mean, of course, your critique of the American employment situation is correct. I agree with it. But you're assuming that's the only lever we have to pull. It is not. We could also have low-income housing. We could have rent control, rent stabilization, as New York has in parts of Manhattan. That would change the economic mix of the neighborhood. And to generalize, and maybe this is wrong, I think usually the more affluent people moving into the neighborhood are not the ones raising the banners for those kinds of policies. And so to that degree, yeah, they do have some individual responsibility. I'm not telling them not to buy their apartments and houses, but you can also think about what kind of neighbor you are to the people who were there for generations or many years and, you know, how much respect and just sort of decency.
Also, couldn't he just be using it rhetorically? I mean, the way people used to talk about yuppie. I mean, that he's using a radioactive symbol to get at this whole series of issues that we're talking about. So he's just saying they are the result of a lack of policy that doesn't create some kind of enclave and protection for the old Brooklyn.
But Emily, right. I would say that, in fact, I wouldn't say this of Manhattan, which is populated by, you know, just a huge banker class and a kind of transcontinental elite that I find generally repellent. But I do think of Brooklyn, like there's a hyper-consciousness of creating this as a city, and a city that's variegated and that's conscious of how – of making it a good place to live with varieties of human experience. And there's an intense interest in urban experimentation in Brooklyn. Now there's also a lot more money, but it's not simply like – I'm rich. I'm going to come and take your house and develop it. It's like, let's create a cool neighborhood. Let's try some new things.
Yeah, but it's like the crafty creative class. It's not working class older black people, right? And you can think that it's more aesthetically pleasing to you than the banker class of Manhattan, but it's not a group of people who is being led by the people who used to live in Brooklyn and feel a different sense of ownership of Brooklyn. And I think Spike Lee is mourning that passing.
Yeah.
It may be kind of over the top and irrational, but it seems like he is actually speaking about a real thing.
Most of the hipster young white people I know in Brooklyn are people who are like doing things like starting charter schools in Brooklyn. But
they're also doing things like starting, you know, stores with like artisan pretzel making. I mean, they're not all starting charter
schools.
There's both.
There's both strains of it.
Right.
I guess I would say if you say it, it's simply the pretzel shops and the cupcake shops and the yoga studios, you miss a strong idealistic strain that pervades this new urban philosophy. And I think you see it profoundly in Brooklyn.
I think that can all be true. And some of that energy, one hopes, and probably does, go into reaching out to people who are genuinely different from you in terms of race and class. But I still think it is possible to have the best intentions and have some of that energy and have a lot of people feel pushed out who once thought of this place as their own.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, we'll discuss the remarkable legacy of filmmaker Harold Ramis. And then Disney's Frozen. We weren't going to talk about it, and then it took over the world. And then why do writers put it off and put it off and put it off until virtually the whiff of death hits their nostrils? We'll discuss a provocative theory about procrastination. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, the great Harold Ramis has died from complications due to something called vasculitis. He was 69 years old. He was a veteran of Second City Improv Troupe, and he had a big hand in creating slob comedies, the classic ones, Animal House, Stripes, Caddyshack. In the 70s and early 80s, he acted in and co-wrote Ghostbusters, and then, of course, produced his masterpiece. He was the director and co-writer of Groundhog Day, one of the best, if not the best, American comedies since the heyday of Billy Wilder. Dana, what was your reaction when you heard this news?
Well, in addition to just seeming too soon to lose this director, he was only 69 and he was still making comedies. His last one, I think, was 2-3 years ago. it just made me think of how much he and his school of comedy writing sort of changed American comedy. That essentially, you might think of him as the Judd Apatow of his time, just in the sense that he formed this sort of school of comedians around him. So as you said, even though he may not have directed many of those films, he's very, very strongly associated with this whole sort of school of sketch comedy that grew up in the early days of Saturday Night Live and SCTV.
Julia, I remember first seeing or first becoming conscious of who Harold Ramis was back on the old Second City TV television show back in the late 70s, and it ended up launching the careers of John Candy, Ramis, and later Martin Short. It was said about Lou Reed when he died that he launched a million indie bands. Harold Ramis launched a million comedy nerds, both with that show and then those slob comedies from the 70s. What do you take away from that legacy?
I mean, it's a little hard to separate Harold Ramis out from my childhood experience of some of his biggest movies. I mean, I saw Ghostbusters as a kid. Like, I remember, like, running around at recess and everybody singing the Ghostbusters theme song. And so it's been interesting to kind of reconsider his work as a grown-up person with a critical sensibility and just think how much they hold up. I did rewatch Ghostbusters, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, and that is just a great, great film. And I'm trying to think about what distinguishes it from its descendants today. You know, it's an original script with schlocky effects and a lovable band of misfits. In some ways, that's become the template, right? You know, it's like every movie does a version of that now. But when you watch it, few of them seem to achieve the charm and the wit and the genuineness of the original.
All right, why don't we listen to a clip from Ghostbusters?
Your girlfriend lives in the corner penthouse of Spook Central. She's not my girlfriend. I find her interesting because she's a client and because she sleeps above her covers. 4 feet above her covers. She barks, she drools, she claws.
It's not the girl, Peter, it's the building. Something terrible is about to enter our world, and this building is obviously the door. After the First World War, Shandor decided that society was too sick to survive. And he wasn't alone. He had close to 1,000 followers when he died. They conducted rituals up on the roof. Bizarre rituals intended to bring about the end of the world, and now it looks like it may actually happen.
So be good, for goodness sake.
Yeah, you know, David Edelstein in New York Magazine, the film critic for New York, had a nice obituary for Harold Ramis where he talked about him as a straight man, which you very much hear in that clip, and, you know, how solemnly he played that hyper-intellectual character that he was in Ghostbusters. You know, that was the anchor that was needed for all the crazy people he was always acting against. He was always mixing it up with, or his writing was mixing it up with, Belushi and Bill Murray and Chevy Chase and, you know, huge, broad, physical comedians who played things very big, and that he would be sort of the calm at the center of that storm.
Yeah, I agreed that he himself was not much of a performer or an actor or a screen presence, but somehow having him there was the center of the storm around which the storm could kind of cohere a little bit. And I think that that's a big point, because there's a real difference between the early movies that he made, which really were homages to immaturity, like kind of unalloyed and in some ways genuinely offensive homages to immaturity, like Animal House. But they were also designed a little bit cynically to tell young boys that their worldview was the appropriate one, right? Like an insecure, and I can tell you because I was one such moviegoer, right? That an insecure boy, that their anti-establishment sense of the world and also their sense that they were noble for being such incredible slobs. They were thought as extremely crude and lowbrow, and people like Warren Beatty ragged all over them publicly and then had to eat crow when he himself tried to make one in Ishtar. But the fascinating thing was Ramis was the calm and mature sensibility at the heart of those movies, and he was the one who over time grew up into a really gifted filmmaker. I mean, he gave the world Belushi's Bluto, right? And he gave the world, you know, Murray in those classic slob comedies, but he himself was not a slob, and that was reflected in the movies as he grew into really a remarkable director and writer.
It's interesting. I read somewhere that Judd Apatow seems to be kind of the clearest descendant of Ramis in that he's gathered these young male comedians around him and built this whole constellation of movies about male slobs. And in Lena Dunham now, some female slobs as well. But I'm curious how you guys think that the Apatowian universe is different from the Ramis universe. Like, is it really just the direct descendant, or are there some some ways that our culture perceives immature men that are different than they did 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. It doesn't feel to me like it's a direct descendant. It feels to me like Apatow took the torch and then took it to a very different place. But I have a hard time saying exactly how, in part because I was not part of, you know, the kind of guy cult that worshipped movies like Caddyshack and Meatballs. I saw all those movies once and I laughed at them, but the quotable quotes is very much a guy thing from Harold Ramis. I don't know, Steve, do you have something more to say about that? What's the essence of his comedy that Apatow didn't pick up?
It's got to be generational, right? I mean, these guys were all products of the 60s, so the premise of those movies is all the same, which is that some institution, whether it's a golf course or the, you know, military or on and on, is so smug and so hidebound that it deserves whatever treatment it gets at the hands of these pranksters. And I think that was just a different era in American life. That was a presumption that, you know, everyone under the age of 35 shared that presumption up until about 1980. And then starting in the 80s, you know, the world changed and it's much less, I would say the slob or kind of Apatowian comedies of today are much more peer-based. I think when you get to Lena Dunham and Judd Apatow, you're talking about, if you're talking about someone being a slob or a slacker, it's relative to their own peers. It's way more lateral. And that means that it's lost its, the bite is no longer that satirical, or to the degree that it's satirical, it's, the joke is now on the protagonist.
And outside of comedy, that really just speaks to the decline of institutions in American life, right? I mean, if they're no longer the thing that you rebel against, then, you know, you are, as Steve puts it, you're in this lateral universe of just comparing yourself to other humans.
All right. Well, we should say that Harold Ramis would probably kill us for turning him into a kind of institution and turning his career into a maturity parable. But we've done it and we can't escape it. So we're going to own it by finishing with his wonderful cameo in Judd Apatow's Knocked Up.
I have a vision for how my life would go, and this definitely is
Wait,
not...
Wait, is this your it. Vision? Are you living your vision right
I
now?
I am kind of living my vision.
Wow, that is sad, I'm telling you. Life doesn't care about your vision, okay?
Stuff happens, you just got to deal with it. You roll with it, that's the beauty of it all.
Honestly, though, when you look at me, do you not think at all, like, well, if he just never existed, I would have avoided a massive heap of trouble, you know?
Absolutely not. I love you totally and completely. You're the best thing that ever happened to me.
I'm the best thing that ever happened to you?
Yeah.
Now I just feel bad for you.
That is such a nice scene between him and Seth Rogen. I love that moment in Knocked Up. But just so that we don't end our Harold Ramis segment on too mature and Buddhist of a note, I also want to just note that his last movie, Year One, which was from 2009, is as immature, silly, and stupid as you can get. And I was one of the few critics who really, really liked it. Year One is about two cavemen, played by Jack Black and Michael Cera, kind of stumbling through the ancient world, you know, stumbling across the pyramids. And it's just this absolutely ridiculous National Lampoon-style fantasy of early humanity.
All right. Well, rest in peace, the great Harold Ramis. Come to our Facebook page and tell us what movies of his you cared about particularly. We're at facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, why is Disney's Frozen so hot with the tweens? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. Frozen is a 2013 American 3D computer-animated musical fantasy comedy film produced by Walt Disney Animation Studios and released by Walt Disney Pictures. Let It Go is the song at the center of the movie. It's become something more than just a power ballad. It's a kind of cultish trigger for young girls, apparently. Dana, you didn't review this movie for Slate. Dan Coyce did. You think it's nonetheless a good movie, at the heart of which is a very sincere qualm. Talk to me about Frozen.
Yes, you're right. I didn't review Frozen for Slate, not out of any lack of desire to see it and review it, but there was just a lot coming out, and it was a kids' movie at a time that a lot of big grown-up movies were coming out, so it sort of got by me. And then I did end up writing about it later because of the hugeness of the song, and that was how I came to know Frozen. And it's the reason that I feel like I don't really have much of a critical perspective on the movie. I basically love Frozen because my daughter loves it and all of her friends love it, and it's seeped into our consciousness, and that song has become part of our DNA. And yet there is this moment in the performance of Let It Go, which is, I guess you could argue, sort of the the climactic song, at least emotionally the climactic song of the movie, that bothers me every time I watch it, and not least because it seems to be a moment that resonates very strongly with little girls watching the song, and it doesn't seem to me to go with the general spirit, the sort of very sweet and feminist spirit of the movie Frozen. Julia, I've been talking for so long. Do you want to take it away and set up the song a little bit?
Let me give a little context of the plot of the movie, and then we can kick back to you, Dana, and you can explain your beef with the song. So the movie is novel and remarkable in part because it focuses around a sister relationship rather than a romantic relationship. So it's the tale of two sisters, one who has magical ice powers that beget the title of the film. She can conjure snow and ice with her touch, but it's a magical power she can't quite control. And in an effort to keep her loved one safe, she's been hemming it in and keeping herself protected and wearing gloves. And her younger sister doesn't know the reason for this and is very confused and saddened by this isolation. So Let It Go is the moment in the movie when this older sister with the magical powers, her name is Elsa, runs away from civilization to a solitude in the icy mountains where she builds a beautiful crystalline ice palace with her powers and throws off the shackles of the world and her efforts to keep the world safe by letting go of constraints and embracing who she truly is. All of which makes up for a powerful, walloping ballad, but there is a moment in it that's a little bit galling. So Dana, explain what galls you.
All right. So after Elsa creates her ice palace, right, it's this very thrilling. I mean, you might compare the song to Whitney Houston's what's her self-empowerment anthem, the greatest love of all, or to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. The song up until then has sort of had that tone of like, I'm going to own my talent and own my power. And you see her sort of learning to harness her ice power. And it's kind of the moment that she's reaching for the height of what she can be. And it's the precise moment before she decides, for no apparent reason, since she's completely alone in the ice palace, which is the whole point, her isolation, that she needs a makeover. The cold never bothered me anyway. And this is the moment. It's about 10 seconds of the song that bother me every time. And I've taken so much heat for saying this, but do you guys agree with me that at the moment that she creates herself this kind of skin-tight, slit-to-the-thigh snowflake dress, pulls her hair down out of its bun, and starts to strut in high heels onto the balcony of her new ice palace, that there's just kind of a, I don't know how to describe it, but there's a pageant, a beauty pageant, or a kind of Beyoncé-fication, or an American Idol moment that just feels like it's in there for the marketing. It doesn't feel like it's true to the spirit of the song and what's happening to Elsa at that moment.
Well, I mean, it does the thing that whatever, second wave, third wave feminism, I forget which wave, suggests that you can empower yourself through appropriating standards of glamour and beauty and just making yourself as powerfully and potently beautiful as possible. But yes, it seems jarring when she loosens her braid from an uptight folkloric braid into a tousled and loose, like post-coital braid, and starts switching her hips as she teeters out on her high heels into the ice promenade that she's built for herself. And I agree.
I do find that song a little sinister. I have two daughters, one of whom is unrelievedly girly and in her own self-stylings, princessy, and one of whom's a complete tomboy. The effect on my daughter, who's the tomboy of this song, has been insane to watch. You don't just like the song. You don't just thrill to it in the context of the movie. You do perform it and re-perform it, and you play the video and perform along with it. And the message is unmistakable, which is that in addition to releasing your suppressed superpower and glorying in your own hidden abilities, bound up in that is massively sexualizing and feminizing yourself. And my daughter at the age of 11 is capable of seeing that intellectually, but she's also incapable of battling against it emotionally. And so I do think it's vaguely insidious.
People also wrote me in protest when I published this objection to those few seconds in the song, saying that it's completely appropriate that there would be a more sexualized moment for that character at the end of that song, because the movie is an allegory about adolescence and how the younger daughter, Anna, is sort of regretting that her older sister is passing into this world that she can't be part of. And I suppose if you're making that argument, you can live with it. There's still, though, there's something about the way that that stage, that it's really clear to me that it comes from a different register of culture. It comes from a register of display and of styling and fashion and, you know, displaying your body.
The movie is Frozen. It's from Disney. Go check it out if you haven't already. You probably have, but we're curious to know where you fall in this debate about its feminism and its heart.
All right, Steve, are we ready to start our third topic yet, or should we do a couple other things first?
You know what? I'm getting a little notification on my Facebook. Hold on one second. All right, har har. All right, well, most writers manage to get by because as the deadline creeps closer, their fears of turning in nothing eventually surpass their fears of turning in something terrible. So wrote Megan McArdle in last week's Atlantic Monthly in her piece, Why Writers Are the Worst Procrastinators. We all know why we're the worst people in the world, right, Julia? So we have the easiest job in the whole world, and yet we whinge the loudest about it. What I found interesting about this piece, Julia, is that it posits a theory as to why, a scientific or pseudoscientific, at least, theory as to why. What do you make of the piece? What do you make about procrastination? You must, as an editor, deal with hideously late writers all the time.
Well, I have so much to say about procrastination, but I'll get to that in a moment. First, I think we should talk about this Atlantic piece, which provides us with a juicy opportunity to talk about procrastination. But I can't say that in and of itself I found it to be particularly compelling or persuasive. She starts with the premise that writers are particularly terrible procrastinators and then proposes to offer an explanation for why. Her explanation seems to be that writers are often people who are like the top students. They're nerds. They loved reading. They did well in school. So they're used to a sense of achievement and perfection. They have very high standards for themselves. And therefore, they are afraid to put forth into the world something that is less than amazing. And so they would rather put forth nothing and rewrite their to-do list and water all the plants in their house and make themselves another cup of tea. And while they're at it, maybe a bagel before sitting down at the computer to actually put words onto the screen and usher them into the world where they could be found wanting. I think the overall diagnosis that procrastination often stems from a fear of failure is true. I think the notion that writers are somehow particularly prone to procrastinate seems completely bogus. Everybody in the world procrastinates, and also many people who are excellent students go on to do things other than write. It's not like all the best students in the world become writers and everybody else has to go, I don't know, become an engineer because they were the dunces.
Like, and it's not like many, many writers haven't been complete failures at school or any kind of institutional.
Yeah,
effort.
I mean, this notion, I mean, basically, she's a writer writing for a website read by other writers. It seemed like a very self and audience flattering notion to suggest that writers are like the creme de la creme academically.
Like, completely agree. I don't think she made the case for why people that just put off going to the post office don't do the task that they're supposed to do. I didn't think there was anything writing specific in her argument.
Yeah, but the theory overall, I think, is one, you know, there have been a lot of students of procrastination and a lot of academic studies of procrastination. I think the notion that procrastination is tied up with a fear of failure, a fear of exposure, you know, a fear that if you make the attempt at something big, you might find that you're not capable of something big, so why don't you fritter away your time doing a lot of things that are small? That, you know, rings true, I think, to anyone who's ever suffered from procrastination, which has to be every single human on planet Earth, right?
Yeah, no, I basically agree with your take on the piece. I like the piece. And what I thought was most interesting about it is actually a different part of the thesis, which a Columbia researcher claims, I'm basically quoting from the piece now, that people who dislike challenges think that talent is a fixed thing that you're either born with or not, and that people who relish challenges think that talent is something that you can nourish by doing stuff you're not good at. That started to resonate with me, and it started to make me think about why perhaps, Julia, writers are uniquely prone to procrastination. Here's my theory. I think that writing is as close to an untestable an ability as there is in the modern world. You can test someone and get some grasp of whether or not they'd be a good physicist or even linebacker, but finally, at the end of the day, there's nothing but the pudding when it comes to writing, right? There is absolutely no empirical metric by which you can dipstick someone and come up with a score and say that even their verbal SAT will not tell you whether or not they can be a good writer. So every single time you do it, you're in danger of proving to yourself you're precisely the idiot that you think you are. And so I actually do believe the basic premise of the piece, which is that writers are terrified of proving themselves, and they are uniquely prone to procrastination.
But, you know, the day that we decided to talk about this procrastination article last week happened to be a deadline day for me, so I decided that by way of research I would sort of keep notes, at least mental notes, on what my procrastination trajectory was like that day. And I wanted to share a few of the moments that I found myself not writing and some of the things I was doing, and to see what some of you guys' activities are that you engage in when you're not writing. So one thing that I noticed, and this is very unflattering, this is really seriously getting into, like, taxicab confession time, but one thing I noticed that I found myself doing is I would find myself at the mirror. I would be, like, putting on makeup or perfume.
And I thought about, no, I was thinking about Clarice Lispector, the Brazilian novelist, who's one of the great writers of the 20th century, who nobody seems to know because she wrote in Portuguese. But she had this beautiful thing she wrote about sometimes putting on perfume in order to write. You know, it's this moment where you're just sitting there with, for her, the typewriter, for me, the blank page, and just what your mama gave you. Steve, come on. What's one of yours?
I masturbate. No. That's just a joke. I've actually never masturbated in my life. But the truth is I do basically two things, right? The first is I totally kid myself. I totally delude myself into thinking that I'm actually working on the piece. Look, I haven't procrastinated at all. I'm researching, right? And then I do a just preposterous amount of research, like absurd. So that's method number one. Method number two is never settling on a place to actually sit and do the writing.
Uh-huh.
I'm a laptop writer. I don't have a desktop. This goes to the absolute heart of my neurosis. I mean, this Dr. Freud, we are now at the primal nut itself, because it took me forever to write my book proposal for this now overdue book. And I would wander all over my house at the time in Brooklyn, looking for a place where I could finally write it. And I settled on the little pink quilted tiny bed of my younger daughter, who at the time was probably 2 or 3 years old. And for some reason, I felt safe and comfortable there, and I finally wrote it. And I'm still like that. I basically need to set up my official desk and put all my stuff there and my books and sharpen my pencil and put it down. And then I need to get as far away from it as possible. And then finally, somehow, I'm liberated to start writing.
Steve, I'm the exact same way. I never sit at my desk. And the entire day is sort of a panther-like prowling around the apartment with the laptop, trying to find the right place to write. I've got to try the kid bed. I think once in a while I have ended up there. But yeah, that sounds regressively pleasant.
All right. Well, why don't you come to our Facebook page and tell us what a bunch of navel-gazing nimrods we really are as writers. And the piece, once again, was Why Writers Are the Worst Procrastinators, The Psychological Origins of Waiting and Waiting and Waiting and Waiting to Work by Megan McArdle in the Atlantic Monthly. All right. Well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse Da-na-na-na-na-na. What do you have?
Well, I want to endorse the Gerard Manley Hopkins poem Pied Beauty, but I want to tell a little story.
I love
about
that poem.
Isn't it the greatest poem ever written?
So
I'm sure most of our listeners actually know this poem. So Pied Beauty is this poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, the Victorian poet and Jesuit priest, who I think is one of the great users of the English language, certainly from his time, was completely ahead of his time in sort of reinventing English language poetry. And it's somebody that everybody reads sort of in high school or maybe in college, but I still love to just crack my Gerard Manley Hopkins book at any time and read one of his poems. And it so happened that he came up in my daily life in this wonderful way this week, where I was reading a book to my daughter about baby animals, and the word dappled appeared in this book. And she asked, what does dappled mean? It was about a baby tapir, which I didn't realize have sort of fawn-like dappling on their coats. And so we were talking about the word dappled and what it meant and how it meant something that was speckled and sometimes that light could be shining on something in such a way that it was dappled. And then I just, of course, couldn't help but remember the first line of Gerard Manley Hopkins' Pied Beauty, which is, glory be to God for dappled things.
All right, Julia, top that.
This week I want to endorse the fifth episode of Looking. Looking is a series about three gay friends in San Francisco. It's engendered a ton of conversation, including at some of our Sister Slate podcasts. And I think it's really good. One of its creators is Andrew Hay, who made that movie Weekend that we all talked about and loved a couple years ago, which is a really romantic tale of a weekend-long date. And the fifth episode of Looking is somewhat similar. It's almost like a short film in the weekend vein, because almost all of the characters in the ensemble drop away. It's structurally very innovative for a TV show, and it simply focuses on one day-long date between the lead in the show, played by Jonathan Groff, who also voices one of the characters in Frozen, and a new love, Richie, played by Raul Castillo. And they have kind of a day-long date, getting to know each other and seeing what they think about each other and what the possibility might be between them. And it's so romantic about love, about discovering other people, about human connection, about the city of San Francisco, which is its own kind of third character in the episode. So I recommend that you check out the fifth episode of Looking.
All right. Well, I just want to say that this is an especially heartfelt and sincere endorsement on my part. And we've been doing the show for about 4 or 5 years, 5 years, maybe more. You know, this is a big moment. This is a little bit like Edmund Burke admitting that he was wrong about the French Revolution, which is I made granola the other day and I put shredded coconut in it. I did that, and I'm glad I said it. Now I've said it, and I'm glad I've said it. And it's the best freaking granola you've ever had. I'm not throwing down any gauntlets. I'm not trying to talk some smack. I'm not trying to dig up, you know, old blood feuds. All I'm saying is that I had one friend named Naomi who gave me what I thought was the greatest granola recipe ever. Well, I have another friend named Naomi, and she gave me the just all-time greatest. It's such a counterintuitive granola recipe. It's so counterintuitive. It comes all the way around 360, and you put in the coconut. It's so good, and this one I can make public. So go ahead and email me. This one, it doesn't have to be held dear like an old family secret. So,
Steve, I think you're right. We probably shouldn't go back and play the clips of when you referred to the notion of putting coconut in granola as like a strumpet or a whore, like flaunting her wares or whatever it was you actually said. I think you're right. There's no need to go back and revisit those moments.
Can I also note that I love that you have two separate friends named Naomi who are plying you with granola recipes? It's like a strange eternal return quality. Like every day a new Naomi will show up with a granola recipe.
And it's like your Groundhog Day. It's like granola day. If there are any Naomis in our audience who make great granola, like, you could be next.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Julia Turner, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Dana Stevens, as always, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. And this week we're going to go out on Dana Stevens-Daughter's rendition of Let It Go. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
Snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm a queen. A wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Gotta keep it in, heaven knows I've tried. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl, always have to be. Conceal, don't feel. Don't let them know. Well, now they know. And I don't want to spoil the chorus. No.